Our course, our topic that we're going to study, at least until the Chagim, thought it relevant given that this is an election year, is Jewish political thought. Let's start off by saying what this is not going to be. Okay, this is not going to be a course which should affect one way or other which how you decide to vote in November. Okay, we're not going to be talking. Hey Naomi, we're not going to be talking about those sorts of political issues in that sense. Not that the Torah and Judaism doesn't have things to say about distribution of resources, about all sorts of other things that play a role in political campaigns. But what we're going to do is to spend time looking at some of the most basic questions of politics. They're so basic that even people who think of themselves as being into politics in the regular stream, they don't necessarily spend much time thinking about. These are really going to be questions about power and about balances against that power. So if that sounds too broad, let's start with Parashat HaShavua. Really, it could not be. Maybe that's the reason why we're starting today on Labor Day, because there could not be a better week in the whole of the cycle of the Parashiyot to start a course on Jewish politics than Parashat Shoftim. Shoftim presents us with four different categories of leadership within Am Yisrael. What are they? Most obvious one is in the first word of the parasha, Shoftim. Okay, which will translate as judges. Navi, right? The Navi, the prophet, is another one. Sorry, Melech is going to be the critical one, the king, and sorry. So what is the difference? I'm going to see understand that Shotrim are a version of Shoftim. One, sorry. I think that would also be Shoftim. No.
Okay.
People don't be through the fire, I guess. It's only Monday. Levi'im. Okay? Maybe we don't think of Levi'im as being in a leadership position, but certainly, especially in a society like the Torah sees of a religious society, the Levi'im play a very significant role. The one that is going to be most important for us to look at today and really going forward is going to be the Melech. Right? And understanding how the Torah in this sense, may well maybe multiple options there, how the Torah views the idea of the Melech. And I've cheated a little bit by calling this a Gemara Shiur. It's not really a Gemara Shiur, in that today is going to be primarily focused on three central prakim, three central chapters in Tanakh, about how to view the king. And then we're sort of going to jump the Talmud, and we're going to spend the rest of the time in the Middle Ages. Okay? Because it's in the Middle Ages that people who are some of the greatest of the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Rabbeinu Nissim, the Abarbanel, people like that, are going to devote a huge amount of thought to the way in which politics and a society should be set up. People who are, for the most part, in Europe and have got a lot of different models to be looking at, and then they're going to be drawing on the sources both in the Tanakh and in Chazal, and they're going to be combining them with what they're seeing in front of them in Europe in the Middle Ages, and they're going to be presenting very different ideas of the way in which politics should be. And this is then going to be very relevant 800 years after the Rambam, when it comes to maybe less America, but certainly Medinat Yisrael, and the significant amount of thought that is given by rabbis and others, certainly in the early years, as to how a Jewish state, for the first time in 2,000 years, how it should look, what sort of model should be drawn. So all of that is really, in many ways, going to begin in our parashat. So do grab a chumash. They should be here. You can use this if you want, and we will be using this for the Tanakh element of it, but I thought you might want the bigger print for now. And we're going to open up to Devarim chapter 17. This is going to be the verses that we're going to come back to again and again when considering the different models. As we read through it, the topic, the question that we're going to always be having to think about is, how is the Torah viewing this idea of a king? Is it viewing it as the encapsulating the ultimate vision of what the religious Jewish state can look like. The king is at the head of that. Is it maybe just not something that the Torah particularly celebrates, but it's just a necessary part of how society is to be structured? Or maybe a third option is the Torah actually looking at it in almost a negative way and only as an accommodation to what people are going to want. But if it were to be up to the Torah wouldn't, ideally, Lechatchila, wouldn't have the institution of a king. But three different options, okay, I think you've got at the start. Let's begin. So this is Sheni, Pasuk Yud Dalet, verse 14, so page 1028, Ki tavo el ha'aretz, when you come to the land, asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach, which Hashem your God gives to you, v'yirishta, and you inherit it, v'yishavta ba, and you settle in it, v'amalta, and you will say to yourself, asima alai melech, I will place upon myself a king, we as a people will appoint a king over us. Interesting, it's put in the singular. Kechol ha'goyim, just like all of the nations, asher svivati, that are around us. We look around us and we see nations have got kings. We also want to have a king. That's going to happen. Then, tzom tasim alecha melech, you shall appoint a king over you. Lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri, you won't be able to place a Gentile over you, asher lo achicha, who is not one of your brothers. Just from those first two pasukim, what can you pull out about which of the three options I gave, or your own option? Forget the options I said. How do you feel that the Torah is looking at it? Maybe even let me ask a simpler question. Is there a mitzvah to appoint a king? Say no.
I was going to say yes.
Oh, okay. Go on, Philip. From the verses, where what's the element of commandment? Som tasim, right at the beginning of that second pasuk, verse 15. You shall surely place it upon yourself. That sounds like an imperative.
But it doesn't seem ideal.
Why?
And because the previous pasuk ends, where it says, "Ve'amarta asima alai melech kol v'im asher svivatai." So it's only if you really look outside and you see that Goyim have a king, and you want what they have, and like Hashem says the next pasuk, okay, fine, you can have a king.
In the JPS translation, it also says, "You shall be free to set the king," not that you shall.
Ah,
so
right.
In that option, it's
what does our art scroll say?
You shall surely.
Fascinating, right? Isn't this it's always a lovely game to play, to read translations in the English, and never to, I mean, sometimes one has bad translations, but often when you're giving a translation, you can't help but put an interpretation on what it is you're going to say. So Dovi, you're really reading that first pasuk in something of a negative light. I mean, the Torah would ideally prefer you not to be looking around and to want to just simply imitate the way in which the nations are. I think that's definitely a very compelling reading. But then nevertheless, the next verse, which Philip then points out, then does sound like it's more of an imperative. Then you shall. So Ben's translation is, you will be free to if you want to, but the Art Scroll translation is, you shall surely. Would it be a way of more positively reading that first pasuk? That Kachol HaGoyim, wanting to be like all the nations, is not a negative in this regard?
Yeah.
Go on.
Like, your reading of it requires us thinking that it's always a bad thing to look at the Goyim and to, like, copy in some way what they do. But you could say that about most of what Jews are commanded to do. It's like make yourself judges. Oh, like the Goyim have judges? Or, like, you know, give sacrifices. Oh, like the Goyim have sacrifices? So, like, it goes back to the central questions, like, is it bad to do what the Goyim are doing? And I would argue maybe. Maybe not.
Say something else. I'd say because the pasuk starts that when you come to the land, there's kind of you like usually you associate only having a king when you have a land to govern the people in.
You're not going to have a king in exile.
Correct. That
okay.
Seems kind of ironic to have a king wandering the desert with the rest of Bnei Israel.
Well, one of the really interesting questions which we're sort of going to look at over the coming weeks is to what extent did the Rishonim that we're going to look at Moshe as a version of a king, or is he some tree?
Well, those look comes to whatever you define a king to be. But it could also be just because it connects the part of when you come to the land with also concluding with the pasuk that how it ends that, oh, like everyone around you, could just be that's the normal thing to do, that when you come to the land, you make a king, just like the mainstream thing to do, not necessarily as because you're looking at other people.
Right.
Maybe that's like a stage of being like settled, like just because it's like saying like once you inherit and you settle in it, it's like, then like once you're at that point of like fully settled that like you're ready to have the king go for you, like then you're like starting to rule the kings and then you go king to king.
So, sorry, just if I understand what both of you are saying correctly, it's sort of to back up what Toby was saying and Sabah, that it's not necessarily a negative thing to look to the nations to want to have a king. Rather, it just happens to come at a later stage because Israel don't have their land until a certain stage down the line. Right? Along those lines?
I would say, yeah, it's completely, like, the pasuk could have ended at Melech. Ve'amarta asim alai Melech peri.
Right, right.
So I think the fact that it includes Kechol Goyim and Asher Sivutai is to some extent, whether it's positive or negative looking at the Goyim, it's completely highlighting that we will be looking at the Goyim.
Would people agree, just to take Toby's question about, you know, what's the value of looking at the Goyim, that as a whole, the general impression you get when reading the Tanakh is that that's not a positive thing in terms of how one wants to build one's own practice. Yeah? That's generally seen though, right? You know, whether it be questions of Avodah Zarah, whether it be certain other practices. We'll finish this discussion at this point, just to put the question out there, might politics be different? Right? Might it be the case that when it comes to the values at the heart of our society, when it comes to very important practices, then the Torah's got a very negative view of how to of taking practices from the Goyim. Could it be when it comes to politics that actually that's a much more neutral question? That's definitely something that's going to become very, very interesting in the coming weeks. Then,
Just to highlight that point, at the end of the parak beforehand, we talked about like not setting up altars, and in that case, it's very negative. It's saying and
right, I noticed that just in the laning this morning. Like, as soon as you said you should appoint Shoftim, and as soon as you said you should pursue justice, on the very next verse is Avodah Zarah, and not taking those practices.
And it highlights the point between like the distinction between the sacred and the political.
Yeah, fair mod.
Additionally, after this, like right after it says you could appoint for yourself a mouth, it says shouldn't have too many wives, shouldn't have too many
Okay, so let's come on to that. Okay, so the next verses, as David points out, now are going to give the stipulations that if you appoint a king, then these are the guidelines that you need to follow. So this is Psukim Tet Zayin to Kaf, 16 to 20. Okay, take just a couple of minutes yourselves to read through those Psukim. I'm going to go and get a glass of water. And then with that, then say to yourself, how does that then affect our view of it? Okay. Do the chavrutah. Let's get the kol Torah and the bet midrash going. So turn to the person next to you. Verses 16 to 20.
What was the beginning of that? But when you have these exceptions, you're more likely to break these exceptions if you do that at the beginning.
Should we come back together?
Yeah, and that's bad.
Okay. So, very, very quickly, before we say what our thoughts are, what have we got? What are the restrictions? Firstly, you've got to be Jewish. That was the first one. Then, not too many horses.
Oh, yeah.
Why horses? What are horses? Yeah, horses represent, maybe if we've got time, we'll talk about what horses are and enough, but at the most basic level, horses are tanks. Right? Horses are power. Okay, that's what they represent, right? What are the most famous horses in Tanakh that you just think of immediately? Exactly, right? The horses of the army of Paro. Horses represent military power. We're being told that our king can't have too many horses. What's the next one?
Gold and silver.
Interesting about returning to Egypt, right? That's one that I've never really...
Does it imply that the horses belong to the nation or the king himself? Like personal horses?
That's very interesting, right? It's interesting to even think of the distinction. So it could be that it shouldn't be his own wealth being too great. I know the Sultan of Brunei's got 200 Rolls Royces or something like that. It should be something against sort of that sort of like opulency. guess the way in which I'd always read it was more in the sense of the nation's military ones, even though that, you know, raises questions. Not returning people to Egypt. Not too many wives. Not too much silver and gold. And finally, the only positive one is what? But when eventually he is there? Sefer Torah. That is with him the whole time. Right? That's also going to become a topic which we'll come to. So, what can we tell from these guidelines, restrictions about the nature of the way in which the Torah is viewing the king?
Not
like
as a normal.
Very different than like a Louis XIV kind of situation. Like, it's not supposed to be like this opulent. It's supposed to be much more of like a politician, I would say, instead of like a king. You know what I'm saying? Like,
not a figurehead.
Right.
I
would say not a politician, I would say.
A religious
a leader.
Religious
leader.
Okay, go on. Have that
like,
conversation.
Think of like a congressman who like comes from your, like they come from your hometown and like they don't have that much more than you and like they're there to represent you. They're not there to like have a huge like Versailles.
I don't know. I mean, I guess that I associate politicians and politics with corruption, for better or for worse.
We'll bring that into the
current presidential candidates and stuff.
Into the conversation. As in, what is the Torah? What's in Elu, if you can say the phrase like this? What seems to be the Hava Amina of the Torah? What is the Torah expecting a king will do if it doesn't have these if there aren't these guidelines to rein them in? Obviously, that a king just left to his own devices will have huge amounts of horses, huge amount many wives, huge amounts of money, etc. In other words, power. It's something that then could know spills into, use Toby's example, spills into a Louis XIV type idea. Could you then connect this back to the first question we discussed in those first two verses? How is the Torah looking at the concept of a king as a whole?
There are a lot of dangers to it.
Right, exactly. That really seems to be. So regardless of whether you go with Philip or with David as to whether or not there is actually a mitzvah, Ben Kach or Ben Kach, either way, the Torah definitely sees it as containing potential for quite some danger. So I'd love to spend longer talking about it, but time is of the essence, so we've got to run to the part in Tanakh where this really becomes relevant. Where do we have our first king in Tanakh?
Shmuel.
Yofi. Shmuel with which king? Shaul is the first king. Now, this is in Devarim, okay? At the end of Devarim, that's on the entrance into the land, right? Sefer Yehoshua then enters into the land. Sefer Yehoshua is a long book, 24 chapters, no mention of a king. What's then in the next book?
Shoftim.
Right, not Shmuel. Shoftim is a book about the same length as Yehoshua, but is actually a far, far longer book in terms of the time it spans. It spans probably something like 400 years, a huge amount of time, and yet no king. Right, the king is waiting to until we get to Sefer Shmuel. What is happening with kings in the meantime? Right? What is there a concept of kingship in Sefer Shoftim? Has anybody learned Shoftim?
It's more like there is a
Shoftim,
which is like
the leader. So, right, I mean, again, it all goes back to Parashat Shoftim in terms of these. What's the nature of those leaders as opposed to being kings?
It's like somewhere between like a spiritual and military.
Right, critically, they're not hereditary. Right, their children don't become royalty after them. That's very important. There is the story with Gideon, where Gideon is told to, is the people approach him and say, you know, essentially, let you and your children rule over us. Sounds something like kingship, and Gideon rejects it very strongly. Why does he reject it? And even if you don't know, let's think about this answer. What is the problem? Forget about kingship in general as a political idea. What is the specifically Jewish problem with kingship? When we spoke about Kachol Hagoyim, what is a problem that the Torah might have that Gentiles might not have? Yafeh Me'od. Right? This is very right. This is now completely distinct from the general question of how we look at a king. Basically, all the stuff that I've written gets to this. So I'll show you one pasuk. Pasuk, this is on the second page. Pasuk in Yechezkel. Yechezkel has got sort of like a rereading of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Very, very, very important. So we read it in a Haftarah. This is the way in which Yechezkel sort of like imagines God speaking about Mitzrayim. V'hayta eretz Mitzrayim l'shmama, and I will lay Egypt desolate. Egypt will be destroyed. V'charba, v'yadu, and they will know. Ki ani Hashem, that I am God. Ya'an amar, since he said, since Paro said. Ya'or li, the river is mine. V'ani asiti, and I created it. That Paro, sort of the ultimate king of the ancient world, or of the Tanakh, didn't just see himself as king over the Egyptians, but really saw himself as God. Right, I have created the river. So in a sense, you could now introduce a different strand, which is also going to become relevant in the coming weeks. Possibly the whole concept of kingship is puzzled from the very start. Right, it's a problematic concept from the very start, because any sort of human king is by nature seen as a rebellion against God's kingship. Right, we call God Melech Malchei Hamlachim. And the Torah's concern is that all of the attention that the people are going to give to a king will therefore detract from the attention and the obedience they'll give to God. So that would seem to be one of the reasons why, obviously the Torah knew about kings. It wasn't until they got to Sefer Shmuel, they thought, oh, why not have a king? They could look around them and know that there were kings there. But that seems to be one of the reasons why it's delayed. However, that's one episode in Sefer Shoftim. That's really Gideon's response, that you're to appoint me as a king over you is to rebel against God. I don't want to be a part of that. But does anybody know the line that repeats itself time and time again at the end of Shoftim? Basically, every chapter and every story ends with this. In fact, it's even the final line of the book of Shoftim as a whole. Sefer Shoftim describes the collapse. Right, so that's the theme, right? It's just this collapse of the society, the terrible story of Pilegesh Bagiva. If you haven't read it, eventually it devolves into all-out civil war. And the line that repeats itself again and again, and is the final line in all of the... That's earlier on. Nope. Exactly, right? The very final line of Sefer Shoftim, which just repeats itself. Throughout Bayamim Hahem, in those days, Lo Haya Melech BeYisrael, there was no king in Israel. Ish HaYashar BeEinav Ya'aseh, each man would do as was right in his own eyes. Implying, were there to be a king, were there to be some unified sense of leadership, then we'd have a chance, and this anarchy that we see around us, religious, social, political, moral anarchy, would be reined in. Okay, that's a line to remember. In those days, there was no king in Israel. In other words, it sounds like a plea for a king. A king would prevent that from happening. So you've got these very, very different themes. On the one hand, kingship can be seen as a rebellion against God. That's why Gideon rejects the kingship. That's Yechezkel's reading of Paro. But on the other hand, Shoftim ends with the line, and everyone's repeated it many times, that says, if only we were to have a king, that would give us some sort of unified leadership. Let's turn to Sefer Shmuel, so grab the Tanakh, might be one between two. Sefer Shmuel, Perek Chet, there's another one here. Shmuel Aleph, that's right. So we'll see, this is now really the moment which Sefer Devarim had foreseen, that the people would come to Shmuel. What page is it in those?
585.
Okay. Let's see how he responds. Pasuk Dalet. V'yitkabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael. All of the elders of Israel come. V'yavo el Shmuel haramata. They come to Shmuel. V'yamru elav, and they say, Hinei ata zakanta. You're growing old. U'vanecha lo halchu b'darchecha. Your sons aren't like you. Ata sima lanu melech l'shofteinu. Give us a king. Interesting phrase, right? L'shofteinu. Give us a king as a judge. Right? We're sort of transitioning the two, maybe mixing the two. Kachol hagoyim, like all the nations. V'yera hadavar be'enei Shmuel. The matter is very, very bad in Shmuel's eyes. Kasher amru, as he says, kineit lanu melech l'shofteinu. Give us a king to judge over us. Praise. How does Hashem respond? Listen to the people. What they say to you. Okay, sounds positive. Do give them a king. However, it's not you they've rejected. ki oti ma'asum imloch aleihem. Rather, it's me they are rejecting by wanting to appoint a king. So this first moment in biblical history of an actual request to appoint a king, or what's going to become the formal one, Hashem seems to view it in very negative terms, but nevertheless he says, give them what they're asking. Interesting. Atashem Abakolam, listen to them, etc. Now from Pasuk Yud Aleph onwards, verse 11, this is one of the greatest Republican speeches of all time. Right? Maybe in 21st century America we've forgotten what the word Republican actually originally meant, but essentially it meant opposition to monarchy. Right? If there's a lovely irony here, I guess. If the British represented monarchy in the early American assessment, then the Republican argument was to be opposed to that form of leadership. Every single anti-monarchy speech in history takes as its start and as its inspiration the following psukim from Shmuel. You will never read verses which are more furiously anti the idea of a king than the following ones. Vayomer, and Shmuel said, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Zeyeh mishpat ha-melech. This is what the king is going to do. This is what he's going to be able to do. Asher yimloch aleihem. He's going to rule over you. Ebenechem Yikach, he's going to take your sons, Vasamlo b'merkavato, and he's going to put them in his army, or v'farashav, and he's put them in his chariots, right, or conscript them into war. And he's going to put officers over each of you, right, he's going to sort of really have the state watching you. Pasuk Yud Gimel, v'ebenotechem Yikach, he's going to take your daughters, v'erkachot v'lebachot v'lo'afot, he's going to put them into his service. V'etzadotechem, v'etkarmechem, v'zeitechem hatovim Yikach, he's going to take your fields and your vineyards and your orchards, he's going to take them for himself and give them to his servants, etc., etc. He's going to take your cattle, your flocks, verse 18, v'za'aktem v'yom ha'hu, on that day you will cry out, milifnei malkechem, before your king, asher b'chartem lachem, who you have chosen, v'lo ya'aneh Hashem, and God will not answer you, b'yom ha'hu, on that day. Right, this is powerful, this is furious. However, v'yimanu ha'am nishmo b'kol Shmuel, the people refuse to listen.
Can we make anything out of the fact that that before in Pasuk Vav, Shmuel somewhat misinterprets what B'nai Israel asked for, so they said Sima Lanu, and then he reinterprets it to Tna Lanu, and that's already putting it in a more negative versus they might have they might have been kind of asking for someone to be put upon them, and he immediately jumps to this kind of crazy power hungry king.
You're completely right. That's the play throughout the perek between ten Tni and Lasim, which goes back and forth. Yeah, if we were to really be doing this perek B, and that's really at the heart of it.
I know this is backtracking a bit, but I feel to understand this king exactly, what exactly do they think that this king is going to be different than Shofet? Clearly they didn't think that method was effective. I'm not saying.
Unfortunately,
or not,
we never really have any thorough description in the Tanakh of what a Shofet is. We can read the stories of Sefer Shoftim, but like Toby said, they seem to be military leaders who also have some religious idea. We don't have a sense of exactly what binds them. Later on, Shoftim are understood to be Chazal, and the Bet Din, Chachamim, and therefore it's not one individual who's deciding by their own fiat. It's a group discussion, and critically, a Shofet is not hereditary. Right?
Right.
The children of a Shofet don't then become the Shofet
right, but
after them.
The problem with that they want a system that's built in, because you always have these situations where a Shofet dies, and then there's peace in the land for 40 years, and then the whole pattern happens where they sin or whatever. So is that they want something hereditary because they don't want that lag period?
Possibly,
or
yeah.
Or
this is also a response to the end of Shoftim. We need this unified leadership which will serve as a model for society as a whole to be able to help us.
Mm-hmm.
So at this stage, what would you say is the... is the way in which Sefer Shmuel is looking at kingship and this request? The answer can only be extremely negatively, right? In fact, if we're going to just do a little bit of a Gemara, if you look at this source on the one above the Pasuk in Yechezkel, Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kaf, here you have exactly exactly this discussion, essentially the discussion we've been having. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi said, Kol ha'amor b'parshat melech, everything which is said in the chapter of the king, Devarim chapter 17, melech mutar, what he can do. Rabbi Yehud Omer, Rabbi Yehud said, no, that was only given, lo ne'emra, sorry, parshat melech, meaning what's just been said in Sefer Shmuel. Everything that Shmuel said, that's what a king is allowed to do, says Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, lo ne'emra parshas, that was only said, elekadei la'ayem aleihem, only to terrify them, shene'emar, tzom tasim aleich ha'melech, shetehei eimato alav, that his fear should be upon them. Rabbi Yehuda omer, shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael b'knisatan la'aretz, Israel were commanded three things when they enter into the land, la'hamid lahem melech, to appoint a king, la'achrit zaro shel amalek, to wipe out amalek, believe not lahem beit ha'bechira, and to build a temple. According to Rabbi Yehuda, then, the kingship is part of the sort of the grand vision of, you know, Israel entering into land, so a full-fledged mitzvah. Rabbi Nehorai omer, lo ne'emra parshazu, ela keneged tarum utan. On the contrary, right, this parasha is only said against their future murmurings, where they will say, in the time of Shmuel, amarta asim alei melech. Right, so you've got the whole range of opinions. One views it as one of the three mitzvot they're commanded. The other one views it as, no, this is just to terrify them, so they don't end up doing such a thing. How are we doing time-wise? Let's just finish with this. So it's looking pretty negative at this stage, right? However, if you turn over to Shmuel Perek Tet, we have the story of finding the first king. Who is the first king? Shaul. Who is Shaul? So let's read this story quickly. I just want you to... We're going to see just one lovely thing. There was a man, Vehi Ish Binyamin, Ushmo Kish Ben Aviel Ben Tzvor, etc., etc., Yishivini Gibor Chayim, Velo Haya Lo Ben, he had a son, Ushmo Shaul, his name was Shaul, Bachor v'tov, v'ein ish mibnei Yisrael tov mimenu. He was the best in Israel that there was. Mishichmo v'mala, is from his height upwards, this lovely phrase. And what had happened? V'tovad ha'atonot. They'd lost the donkeys, right? He'd lost his father's donkeys. The kish avi Shaul. V'yomer kish el Shaul. And his father says to him, v'no, kach na itcha et echad mehanarim, take one of our workers and go and look for our donkeys. And they go to Har Ephraim, they go for 3 days, v'lo matzu, they don't find the donkeys, v'yavru be'eretz sha'alim, etc., etc. Eventually they come to a place, and Shaul says to to the person working with him, let's go back, nashuva, pen yechdal avi min ha'atonot v'da'ag lanu, okay, we'll have lost the donkeys, we don't want my father to worry about us. V'yomer lo, and the lad says to him, hinei na'ish Elohim be'ir hazot, there's a man of God in this city, v'ish nechbad, talking about Shmuel, everybody who knows him says they go to him. Perhaps he will tell us what way to go. Perhaps he'll be able to give us a hint. But Yom Shaul na'avo, Shaul says to him, v'hinene lech, we'll go to him. Uman avi la'ish, what are we going to bring him? He can't go to a great man and not bring him a gift. Ki ha'lechem adal, we finished our bread, michkileinu, tshura ein la'avi la'ish, etc. What are we going to bring? But Yosef ha'nar la'anot al Shaul, he kept on giving, the lad gave Shaul answers. And he says the servant, look, I've got some money, kesef, right? We can give that to the Ish Elohim, to the man of God, right? Who gives it to him? The servant. The servant is the one who's got the money, etc. Then we can skip a few verses. Let's go and find our way. And they're trying to find this man, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Heima Olim, the Ma'ala Ha'il. They're going up to the city. The Heima Matzu Na'arot, suddenly a group of girls come out, maidens. Yotzot lishov mayim, on their way to draw water. V'yomru lahen, and they say to them, Hayesh b'zeh haro'eh, is this the place where this great man is? V'ta'anena otam, and they answer, V'tomarna, yesh, hinei lefanecha, maher, go quickly, ataki hayom ba, because the day is almost over, le'oki zevach hayom, there's a festival today, la'am b'marak, avochem ha'ir, when you come to the city, ken tim'tza'un otan, you'll find him, v'terem ya'aleh, ha'bamantab, before you go up, right, they're giving this long, long description, ki lo yachal ha'am, because the people hasn't eaten yet, ad ba'o, until he comes, hu yivarech ha'zevach, right, this is the girls talking, and then pasuk yudalad v'ya'alu ha'ir, and they go up to the city. And Shmuel is on his way to greet them, and then Shmuel anoints him as a king. We haven't got time to really pull this apart, but did anybody notice anything? Did anything ring any bells in this story? This story, this weird story, right? It's a lovely phrase in modern Hebrew. L'chapes atonot v'limtza malchut. Yitzchak? How so? Ah, oh, okay. The shod mine, that is one thing, right? The women are on their way to get water.
Take like the whole biblical narrative. What's the technique called when you look at like Moshe also with the drawing of the well and
absolutely, right. What is the well in Tanakh?
A place where you meet.
Absolutely, right. That's where you meet your beloved. So the women are coming from the well, so that seems to ring a bell of, oh my gosh, Shaul is about to meet his wife. What else? Does Shaul have any money on him? No, his servant does. What's Shaul going to look for? No? Otonot?
Donkeys.
People getting it? Every single one of the guidelines that were put out in Devarim Yud Zayin as to what a king should not do is referenced here, and Shaul comes out from it. Lo yarbe lo kesef azahav. He shouldn't have too much silver and gold. Shaul hasn't got anything on him. He's got to borrow money from his servant in order to give Shmuel a present. Lo yarbe lo nashim. Shouldn't have too many wives, right? Shaul completely ignores the women, right? He passes them by. You know, golden opportunity to get a wife, he misses it altogether, right? Lo yarbe lo susim. He shouldn't have too many horses, and Shaul's got donkeys, right? You can just reference this yourself on the third page. I've put a schema of the of horses and donkeys in Tanakh, right? Horses always represent sort of power, might, materialism. What's a donkey? Donkey's tsanua, donkey's modest, a donkey's much more in keeping, right? That's who Shaul is. In other words, every single one of the potential pitfalls that a king could fall into, Shaul seems to avoid. Right? Shaul is a person who seems to be, in some ways, perfectly made for it. And it's a lovely literary thing by which, you know, referencing all of the things in Devarim Yud Zayin, you see that, actually, possibly there could be a good king, despite everything that has been said. Sorry?
Sefer Torah
is not there. Admittedly, that is absent. That despite all of the potential pitfalls of a kingship, perhaps there is somebody who could do it. That's my favourite thing about horses and donkeys. Let's just finish with this midrash to show how wonderful donkeys are in Tanakh and how the Tanakh has got this whole like war against horses and in favour of donkeys. Moshe took his wife and sons and set them upon a donkey. Avram rose up early in the morning and took with him Ishmael and Eliezer and Yitzchak his son and saddled the donkey. Upon this donkey did Avraham ride. This was the donkey, the offspring of that donkey which created during the twilight. As I said, Avraham rose early, saddled his donkey. The same donkey, that very same donkey, was ridden by Moshe when he came back to Egypt. As it said, and Moshe took his wife and son and set them upon the donkey. This same donkey will be ridden upon him in the future by the son of David. Right, the Moshiach will eventually come to Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Pasuk in Zechariah. Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king comes unto you, just saved, lowly, and riding upon a donkey. Right, so lo yarbe lo susim, shouldn't have too many horses. Shaul is looking for donkeys. What have we seen today? To sum it up, the Torah seems to be very hesitant about appointing king. Perhaps it's a mitzvah, perhaps it's not. There are some reasons why one would be very hesitant about it. However, nevertheless, there once the king is appointed, the Torah is going to see in it promise. Next week, we're going to look at the most important of all Jewish political philosophers, and that is the Rambam, and the way in which he looks at the king. Shakar, everybody. Hope you all enjoy. Oh, gosh.